started our meeting today basically to look at the e-Gamba bill. And before we do the introductions, I must appreciate the posture of members of this committee last week when we were in the joint meeting. We is featured in that meeting as a unit, and which is something we should always try to emulate. We featured there. Nobody would actually say who was which organization or which party, because we spoke in one voice and we spoke on a matter that all of us understood. We sang from the same page, and for me it was very, very important. I mean, it couldn't have not escaped my attention, because that's I think that's the view that having done everything else, there are matters where we should be agreeing them. Politics aside, on this matter, we hold a particular view. And I think there are many areas where, as a committee, we hold those views. So it was good. I think we were able to make a very indelible mark. I mean, we made our presence, and our mark was quite strong. We were not divided. We were one unit, facing one direction, looking at the problem objectively and no politics. So that was something that we should commend, and hopefully going forward. On matters that affect the nation, we should all approach them as people that represent the 55 million people of this country. Because that's basically what we are elected to do. Once we reach this position, that's what is expected of us. And yeah. And thank you to Madam Sheen for leading the way, because she's the person who put her foot first there to state our position, and that's how we were and that's who we were. Madam Judy, you wanted to come in?
Actually, I was watching the proceedings from my bed. And I must say, I found it very encouraging to have seen participation by the members of this committee. Because, you see, our problem is always that we come in at the very last, whether it was with SASSA, and now also as far as the Department of Home Affairs is concerned. And it's very simple to point fingers at one of our entities, and we know the battle that they are fighting to clean up that organization. So it was indeed very encouraging to see members from different parties coming out and saying that we must get into exactly what led to the disruption of services. And we must not underestimate elements that have no good intent but are actually there to protect their own interests. And I think that was what I took out of the meeting, that even the Portfolio Committee of Department of Home Affairs derived a different opinion about what could be behind the CETA dilemma that they're facing. Because initially there was almost antagonistic sort of expression from the department and from the members of that Portfolio Committee. And then once our members introduced the real debate, they understood that there were other things at play and not just what you see, that there was a collapse. You know, it was just too coincidental that everything came down at once. So I think that was the important message that came out of that meeting.
That's not a view from the bed. No, thanks, Julie. View from the sick bed. I think it's an objective view from a person who was looking from a distance. I share the views. Shall we quickly do introductions? This thing that I don't normally do. I must also behave like the rest of the other people. Sir, you are the first at the end.
Well, good morning, members. I'm Sivuile Mazanzi. I write for PMG, Parliamentary Monitoring Group. Thanks.
You can be a very good radio presenter.
Yes, Chairperson, I do radio voiceovers, reading commercials, and and for TV. Thank you.
Morning, Chair. I'm Sean van Breda from the Chief State Law Advisor's Office.
Baba McKenzie.
Cameron McKenzie, telecommunications.
Good luck, McKenzie. You are at the doorstep of the job. You get any job.
Marion Chin from the committee.
Nobuzo Landongene from the committee.
Julie Killian, member of the committee.
Tibi Zodesi, member of the committee.
My name is Jabu Mashango.
Ajira Sali.
Stella Ndabene, Abraham.
Good morning, Chair. Committee members, my name is Omega Shalembe, DDC from the Telecommunications and Postal Services Department.
Morning, Chair, and honourable members, and DM Alf Wilt, DTPS.
And good morning, everybody. I'm Fatima Ibrahim, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Morning, everyone. My name is Puti Pukube from NEMISA.
Morning. My name is Chilwale Ramawa from NEMISA.
Morning, Chair and honorary members. My name is Walter Klaassen. I'm chairperson of the board of NEMISA.
Yeah, so we know who is here. If I don't do it in future, don't blame me. I was actually just influenced by Home Affairs to do the introductions. We shall proceed with our meeting. Basically, our meeting has got two main items. That's the bill, and we have not done with our minutes in a very long time. Hopefully, at the end of the period, we will find time to look at our minutes. Colleagues, I'm going to open up. DM, is there anything that you'd like to raise? We can't ignore your presence.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to all the members of the Portfolio Committee. And on behalf of the department, we would like to thank the Portfolio Committee for giving us another opportunity to come back, clarify certain issues that were raised. We will then take it from there. The DDG will then lead the clarification or the responses to certain things that were raised, and of course we'll welcome further input from the members. Thank you so much.
There were indeed concerns that were raised last week in our short meeting. Mr. Shalembe was here, and I assume that he took note of the issues that were raised. But because we had a short stint to the matter, I would like to allow members to raise issues that they possibly would like to raise with regards to the bill as introduced before we delve into line-to-line a walkthrough. This bill. Are there any matters that members would like to raise? Over and above that, with Madam Shin, you're on the floor. You're the first to take. Anyone else? Madam Julie? Anyone else? Madam Sotetsi? Baba McKenzie?
Is this under general? Or
yes. Okay. No. Yes, it's actually under general, but you can raise any other matter because we have studied the bill. I guess all of us have gone through the bill. If there are issues that are outstanding that really you don't want to deal with them as we go through the bill itself, but just highlights of issues that you'd like clarity on, or the whys and the why not, you know, that kind of a thing, substantive matters. And once we go through the bill, we'll obviously be dealing with some of the substantive, outstanding substantive matters, as well as technical matters that are in the bill. So in the main, it's really general reflections on the bill. The manner in which Madam Shin raised the matter, for instance, last week, is one of the issues that she felt there must be something wrong here. Why only four people? Do we need this bill? Are we wasting monies? Are we not going to be wasting monies? I mean, those are general issues that were raised that are not necessarily in the bill. You also raised, I think, one matter, if I'm not wrong. But indeed, there are matters that could be in the bill, having studied the bill, that members feel they would want to get clarity. Because once we get clarity from the department or whoever else is involved, from the entity or from the legal people, just in general, because once we start to delve into the bill, we'll actually be either adopting the bill as introduced or recrafting certain things that we are unhappy about, as well as dealing with some of the technical aspects of the bill. For now, I think it's just an open, I'm just opening it up for anybody to raise any matter. Having gone through the bill, what is your take, what is your view? Having gone through, I mean, I also reflected on the presentations that came from the people. So it's really open issues that members have gone through, having thought through, and that they would want to raise before we really get into the dotting, to crafting the dots, I mean, to tick the dots and do all those smaller things. Madam Shin?
Thank you, Chairperson. I was concerned that we haven't seen a social and economic impact assessment of this. We've had a business plan drawn up by the department, but we have no CS. Are we going to get one? Because, you know, as far as I know, we don't have one. Also, what concerned me was a lot of the input from the few people who did bother to respond was this confusion about multimedia. And I see that they've made a lot of, they said digitals and multimedia. Well, to me, multimedia is part of digital. I don't see why it needs to be separated out. It's just one of the, you know, digital competencies. And I know that it's done to appease those people who, you know, have a NMISA background, obviously trying to protect that. But to me, if we actually sort of separate multimedia from the rest of it, it makes it look like we don't understand the convergence of the technologies. And I'd like us to perhaps consider doing a definition of what digital is. I mean, I have some suggestions on redoing the definition of digital skills, but to say that, you know, converged technologies have, you know, multimedia, they've got, you know, pictures, words, music, you know, figures, you know, all that sort of stuff. Actually, sort of perhaps we put a definition somewhere there of, you know, let people know that, you know, the producing of documentaries and movies is just one of the many digital skills, not separate.
Hoping the department and the officials from the institute are taking up the issue of Madam Kim.
Thank you, Chair. I hope you will assist me. This is my first bite at the cherry. I missed out last week. Chairperson, I would like to differentiate on the basis of the principle and then issues about clarification about the detail. Now, about the principle, I note that we've had only four and that there were concerns about that. I don't think we should actually calculate the number of submissions. We should rather engage ourselves and say, we have had NMISA. Did we have a legal framework for NMISA? Because if you have any public entity that operates, you should actually make sure that they operate within a very clear legal mandate. So I would argue that it is good that we regulate this body, that is now transformed from being having been Nemisa to a broader responsibility. So I think in the end, it's not the fact that we've had two supporting and two against the entity that is to be established. I think it is for us as legislators, finally we can now regulate what should have been done before. So that's just as far as the principle is concerned. Secondly, when I get to the detail, I share some of the concerns of Honourable Shin as far as the interchangeability, reference to ICT, digital skills, multimedia, etc. And actually, I thought we should also borrow from institutions who work and operate in the field, and I noticed that Cornell University referred to digital skills, meaning digital literacy is the ability to find, evaluate, utilize, share, and create content using information technologies and the internet. You know, so what I'm saying is I think we can work on creating the concept so that everybody is part of that, and we must also bear in mind that this is an evolving industry, so the word may grow in its meaning. Therefore, we should, when we make references in, for instance, functions of NGSE, where you have ICT here and you have digital skills there, etc., etc., that we should actually make sure that we look at the detail. What are we saying, and why do we say it, and to what extent is everybody on the same page with that? Chair, as far as the establishment of NGSE is concerned, Section 2, I noticed that NGSE is established as a juristic person. I want to have clarity what it means if it is established as a juristic person in terms of the PFMA. In some cases, for instance, when you have SAPU, SAPU is also established as a company and registered with the, you know, in terms of the company's act. In this case, you don't have it, hopefully not. Otherwise, the minute that you open the door for this entity to become a company, we've had experience, Jay, at the SABC as well as at USASA, where the board interprets as they wish provisions of the Companies Act and provisions of the Primary Act. And then the argument in the SABC case, you were there, was yes, but the Companies Act trumps the SABC Act, which it was not. In law, the Principal Act applies only in as far as the Principal Act is silenced with the Company Act kick in. Yet, if the Companies Act don't apply, we should just make sure that we have all the provisions that we want in this to legislate correctly for this entity. So clarity about that. Then, it is registered in terms, the Public Finance Management Act is applicable. It means that will the fiduciary responsibility, unless we stipulate it, will that apply to the board? Because the board is actually the accounting entity in terms of the PFMA. So just clarity about that. I've already listed my concerns with regards to functions of NGSE and the interchangeability of terminology. Just last issue is on functions 3, sub 3 of 4B. And one of the submissions actually made reference to that as well, is to interact and foster collaboration with the minister responsible for higher education and training. Now, because this is necessary, and I understand that the entity is registered in terms of post-school legislation, but I think the fostering of collaboration should not only be with the minister of both school education, higher education and training. It should also be with basic education. Because one of the submissions also referred to the need for schools to be part of the growing awareness and use of ICT skills. Then, Chair, I have a concern with regard to Section 6, if it could be explained why the terminology is used. The board is responsible, 6, sub 2, the board is responsible for managing the affairs of NYSE. I would argue that we can refer to giving strategic direction or the accounting authority and giving strategic direction. But having been through the SABC drama, that you see non-executive members becoming part of the daily management, that is, I think, it's a difficult terrain to move into. Then I would like to know I just wanted to see the chairperson must preside at a meeting of the board, but then we do not say that when decisions are taken, and it's actually supposed to meet only 4 times a year, but you know what happens, boards meeting more often. But we don't have a situation that the chairperson, I understand that the board as an entity is accounting authority. But can the board non-executive members, together with executive, meet, have a quorum, and in the absence of the chairperson, actually take a fundamental resolution? We've seen that with the SABC as well. Is it not wise to make reference to either the chair or either the chair or the deputy chair must be present in meetings of the board? Just clarity about that, if there was any reason why we shouldn't include that. Right, then the other matter that is of a concern is if we say the chief executive officer, 16 employees of NYSE, the chief executive officer must on such terms and conditions as the board may determine appoint employees of NYSE. We've recently had a situation that one of the entities' boards decided out of their own to increase the salary package of a company secretary outside of the framework. How do we prevent that? If it is stipulated here that must on such terms and conditions as the board may determine. I'm concerned about that because does the board have wide open rights to determine that, or is it limited by fixed salary packages in terms of the public treasury and the public service commission? How do we limit it so that they can't just be these fantastic salary offers beyond what the package was advertised for, and we've seen that lately with USATA happen. So I'm looking at the detail of the Act, having been through some of the difficulties that we've had with state-owned entities and boards exceeding their authority, and that would be necessary for us as a committee to make sure that when we establish this entity, we're not creating a monster. Thank you, Chair.
Good, Madam Secretary.
Thank you, Chair.
On
4C, can we qualify the word regular or regularly so that you know whether it's every month or second month or quarterly so that we're able to plan oversight? And on 5, we talk about the post-school education that NYSE must consult. I'll do this in conjunction with this one that talks about it's about post-school as well. Usually the interpretation when we say post-school, we talk about people who have matriculated or someone who has a tertiary education. And within part of the target are those who are, you know, not having matric, who dropped out from school. How do you address that? We know IBED belongs to education, but how do you accommodate people who are not matriculated, especially the SMMEs, because we do deal with the SMMEs. When we say we support SMMEs, how do we support them? Those who are not, you know, those who do not have matric. And I'm looking here on the disqualification of board members. I'm looking for a word that will be talking about members must not belong to more than two or three boards, because this actually compromises the quality of the work of the board. Like, what is that here on... But it talks about the efficiency of board members, that the quality of work could be compromised if a member belongs to many other boards. Sometimes a person becomes a board member belonging to only one or two boards, but this time goes on, a person joins other boards as well. How do we deal with that? Oh, this is not it. Yeah, I was looking for this one. It's on 2B and C, that's page 6. It talks about the inability to perform the duties of his office efficiently and the absence from three consecutive meetings. It usually happens when a board member belongs to many boards. If we can deal with that one, or just get us on how do we deal with it moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, we seem to have just gone into the details, so do you want us to carry forward? Chairperson, I'm, to be honest and with the greatest respect to Professor Carson and the board, I'm not convinced that Ikamba actually deserves to exist outside of the department. The ideals of this are very noble. And I also understand its place in the objectives of the National Development Plan. I think my concern is now, as it always has been, that are we not duplicating something that is already out there and available in private sector institutions? For example, when I did a degree through UNISA, one of the first elective courses was a thing called the International Computer Driver's License, which was hosted by private colleges. But you would arrive, they would take you through all the basics of computers and application software, including Microsoft Office Suites, and you would then write a test, an online test based on that, and you were certified internationally with this International Computer Driver's License. So in terms of digital skills and upskilling people, I would imagine that is still out there. If I look at digital skills and multimedia, I look at a school like Vega School, for example, which hosts a variety of courses. And if I just go through, they include things like web design, application development, all the things that I see these collabs doing. And the question must be asked, wouldn't the collabs, for example, be better placed in the department where you have an administrator in the department that administers this program rather than an external board and all the associated costs that come with that? So that's just a general comment. If we also have a look at the free online courses that are available from every university you can imagine, including Harvard, including Oxford, and they cost nothing. They're short courses. You can actually get certified on these, and you can do them online. I can see a language barrier being an issue, but in terms of the courses and course content, that stuff is out there. They mail me 20 courses a week on things like business writing or communicating, various topics. Then, just to go into the document in detail, on page 5, the fourth line down, I just need clarity on the board. The board will be appointed by the minister and made up of by part-time non-executive members, including the chairperson, deputy chairperson, And you say between 6 and 10 members. Is that 6 and 10 members in addition to the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, or a total of a minimum of 6 and a maximum of 10 members? Because we go on, we talk about the CEO as an example, the chief financial officer. Are they included in that 6 to 10? Am I making sense? Then so if we can just maybe tighten that up. And then the third paragraph, in terms of clause 6.6, the ministers in power to either re-advertise or in any other transparent manner appoint a number of qualified persons, etc. Rather than just, and we saw this, I think, if you want a practical experience, the advert for the ineffable, you know, the kind of response you got, sometimes it pays to run these things twice. Could we not suggest that the minister re-advertise for board positions before being empowered to appoint the required number of qualified persons? I think that just gives the public a second bite at that cherry in case they missed it the first time. It's an additional safeguard that holds, that ensures the executive is empowered to step in only when we've exhausted all other avenues. Then, if we go to page 7, the clause actually starts 2.9, second paragraph on page 6, relating to the interests of members. My sister is married to a Russian, and her name is Balchov. If you put my sister and me on paper next to each other, you would find a Russian versus a South African, you know, and there would be no indication that she's a member of my family. So, you know, I could appoint her as a service provider or as a business, and you wouldn't know. And as we know, in our culture, we have people who have various names, clan names and surnames and sisters and nieces. So could we not talk to the interests of immediate family and dependents? I'm not sure what the government's position is on that, or the Auditor General's position, if there is a position defined. But compel members to disclose the financial interests of their immediate family and other dependents that could compromise the board. So we move one step further and just tighten up corporate governance on that. And to prevent members from voting or in any manner to be present during or to participate in the proceedings of any meeting of the board. So it's all related to immediate family or dependents. And then if we can go to page 8, we talk about qualifications and experience, but we don't list these. Could we specifically list the areas of expertise that would be required from the CEO or the CFO? And examples of this could include ICT academia, research, innovation, ICT management, law, digital skills, multimedia, intellectual property, and the commercialization thereof. So just adding in those lists of exactly the kind of people we need to see heading this organization. I know this sounds very impressive, Chairperson, but it's all Honourable Shin's work, just saying. And that's me covered for now. Thank you.
Mama Ndongel.
Thanks, Chair. On page 6, right? Section 11, number 6, a quorum of meeting of the board is 2/3 of the members eligible to vote at that meeting. Can you please tell us how many board members are supposed to be there in management? In fact, how many board members? And then how many board members, when you are talking about the two-thirds now on the meeting? Thanks, Chair.
Just two issues that I'd like to raise over and above over and above what my colleagues have raised. The first one, actually I must end with the first one. Let me start with the middle question. When you speak about the qualification the disqualification of members, we tend to disqualify only politicians. But we do not disqualify an official that is employed in a government entity to become a board member. Am I right? Yeah, we don't. Why? Why? I mean, you can take a CEO of Eskom and he becomes a board member here. Why would we say we don't want politicians, but we want someone else? What is the whole issue about this disqualification? What are we trying to achieve? Just for my interest. The second matter, when it comes to the deputy chair, for instance, and I know we'll deal with these matters when we do when we go through the final details. We are just quiet about the role of that person, except just for his appointment or her appointment. And I think in other legislations, they normally would say, in the absence, this one will do. Here we don't. Is it, do we assume that that would be his responsibility? What if, because it's not prescribed, I mean, the issue that Julie was raising earlier on, that people read too much into what is crafted, and unless you explain it, it gets interpreted. You know, your silence can always be interpreted. That was not the intention of the appointment. And the last question is... something I would have wanted to ask. I referred to it last week. How safe are we to proceed with the bill when only four people have responded? And this question must actually be answered by the lawyers. Both, all of the lawyers, especially the one that is coming from our legislature. Can we safely say we've consulted sufficiently, or whatever the test is? Because we've done what we needed to do, we assume. Can we safely say, if someone were to take us to task, we would at least be safe to say we've done what we could to consult sufficiently. I want that assurance before we delve into the bill. I guess, yeah, those are the questions. And I want to assume that as you respond to the questions, I think they are very detailed questions. As you respond to the question, and it's unfortunate that we do not have a content advisor and no researcher in this committee, it would be prudent that those who will be helping us with the crafting of the bill, that they really start to think through the finer reworking of some of the things in the manner in which we are querying and responding to trying to close the gaps. In other words, when we meet next time, we should actually be saying, we are already working on the first draft of the table document, because it has to evolve over time as we go through. This would, I think the level of questions that have been raised are so substantive that I think we should really be starting to say, as we respond and the committee feels comfortable with our responses, that we start to rework certain things accordingly. So it shouldn't just be a meeting where we are talking, just talking, without really getting into the readjusting of the content of our document. I'm going to open for whoever would like to be the first taker. Preferably whoever. You ask the lawyers to come in.
That has to do with the last question you raised.
Okay. Madam?
Chair, if you want, I can respond to the issues of public participation as a starting point. As you are all aware, it's a constitutional obligation for each house to conduct public participation. The public participation process that is done by a department before it brings a bill for introduction in the NA does not form part of our public participation. So the fact that a department may have consulted with various bodies and done its own advertising process is completely independent from Parliament's duty to conduct public participation. That being said, the courts have been clear that the manner in which we conduct this participation is an internal matter for Parliament to decide. And we look at various factors. We look at the impact of the bill, the reach of the bill. So if I give an example, if we look at national minimum wage, that bill had a far greater impact. Your audience there is far wider than it would be in a bill like this that's a little bit more technical. The only thing that our rules do provide for is that our advertisement period is at least 3 weeks, and my understanding is that that is what happened. And there is no obligation on the public or any other interested entity to participate in the participation process. It is an invitation. Whether one chooses to accept the invitation or not is not a matter for Parliament to be concerned about. What matters is that we have brought the bill to the attention of people in the most appropriate manner. In this case, my understanding is that it was advertised extensively, and notwithstanding that, we still haven't received responses. It's also my understanding that certain interested entities, or entities that we thought may be interested, were well aware of the fact that it was published and there was a call for comments, but notwithstanding that, they haven't done so. Nevertheless, nothing prevents Parliament from taking additional steps. Nothing prevents us from sending an additional letter to stakeholders who we've identified, giving them one more opportunity or asking them to please come and speak to certain aspects in the bill if they so wish. But I'm fairly confident that the process followed to date is legally sufficient. Whether members are comfortable that they have enough information to proceed, or whether you feel you want more input, that is something for you to decide. But legally, I feel that our constitutional obligations have indeed been met, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Minya.
Thank you, Chair. I thought my dirigee would answer all of it, but I'll gladly start.
To clarify, are you still on this one of consultation?
No.
Then Chair, let me...
I don't know.
I'm going to start at the top, Chair. The issue of the SAYS, we did submit the SAYS to the committee as part of the documentation that we submitted. So the SAYS was done in consultation with DPME, accordingly certified. So that was submitted. I am informed that we submitted all those documents, the business case plus this. But we are happy to submit it. Access to know it's nothing that we can submit as early as tomorrow, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Then the issue of definitions. This one we admit upfront. We really got tied here around the nose with definitions. Honourable Shin is right. We had started off with what we understood as the comprehensive definition and of what we are trying to do, and we used a digital skills. But we were aware that in preparing the business case, we were using digital skills, e-skills, you know, almost interchangeably. But when we then put the bill together, we used digital skills, but sort of trying to encapsulate everything that we had said in the business case. The only exception is the matter relating to broadcasting or multimedia. Having done the bill, and as part of our consultation, we met with the National Association of Broadcasters, the current immediate stakeholders to the current NEMISA. We gave them all the assurance that digital skills include multimedia, new media, broadcasting, and all those things, but we just got a sense that they were particularly worried that unless we, even if it is tautological, unless we add the broadcasting so that it's clear and distinct in the bill, they feel that over time the mandate towards broadcasting will be eroded. So as a compromise, then we ended up including broadcasting and multimedia in almost next to digital skills, so almost repeating ourselves there. So Chair, we acknowledge that one, and we will welcome actually assistance in coming with the most all-encompassing apt concept that covers everything we wish to do. The Honourable Kurian did talk about the number of submissions, but emphasized the point that it is important to create the legal framework governing this entity, which has to date operated without a founding legislation, and also to give effect to the transfer of some of the functions which are currently residing in the department to the institute that is being established. We needed legislation to allow us to do that. Our view has always been that this is not a particularly controversial piece of legislation, and as a result, then we didn't expect it to elicit such a huge response in terms of objections to the bill. So we feel, though, it is still necessary to have the bill to then create that framework governing the institute. We've touched on the digital skills definition. Then perhaps a difficult issue, which I will park for the lawyers and the juristic person versus registration in terms of the Companies Act. But just to add that my view and the view that my team has had contributing to the drafting of the bill is that, yes, the bill creates a juristic person, but they need to still register in terms of CIPC, because that actually gives the identity of the company. They get the company number and so on, which allows it to open a bank account and those kind of things. So that has always been my view, but I will wish our legal people to talk in detail on that. Fiduciary responsibilities is captured in the PFMA, certainly apply to the board. Again, there's the issue of terminology here. In the bill, we use the board. In the PFMA, they use the accounting authority. But again, this is understood to mean the same thing. And I think we will lose nothing again if we were to change from using board to accounting authority. The issue of basic education role, I think from conception of this process, we have always understood we are dealing with issues relating to post-school education. Hence then the provisions here to work closely with the Ministry of Higher Education and Training. And post-school includes not only people who have attained matric, but even those that fell off the schooling system and are therefore catered for through community colleges, or in the olden days we used to call them adult schools or night schools, all those people then will still be served through this institute. But there is another point I wish to concede to, that perhaps indeed there is a role of this institute to influence even curriculum development at the school level, you know, and ensure that ICT training awareness takes place even at that level before people exit the schooling system. And if that then is accepted, perhaps I also agree we need to then just quickly consult with basic education and see how we can craft their role here or their cooperation with the institute into the bill. The provision about the board being responsible for the affairs of INESI, our point of departure is that in terms of the governance framework of not only just companies in the private sector, but even in the public sector, the board is entrusted with overseeing the entity. In fact, essentially, the executive authority or the shareholder minister entrusts his responsibility to the board as an agency to the minister, but to act and serve in the best interest of the company. Then it is expected, which gets fleshed out then in other supporting governance documents, that such responsibility, of course, will not be executed by the board on a day-to-day. Then the board delegates this first and foremost to the CEO and to some even of the members of management and the rest of the organization. So that is how we understood the being responsible. And governance also says you still retain the ultimate responsibility of everything you might have delegated to someone to perform on your behalf. So the board at all times will still have to be accountable for even the decisions of management, things that the board would have delegated. And I think similarly it happens again, ministers or shareholders again are responsible for that which they would have delegated to the board to execute in managing the affairs of the entity. So that was our understanding, but I understand perhaps there are even better terminologies we can borrow, like being responsible for strategic direction or guiding the entity, but whichever terminology you use in the final analysis, the board is still responsible for everything that happens in that particular entity. Then the issue of the presence of chairperson and deputy chairperson in meetings as a precondition for those meetings to take place. I think it is good generally that we encourage all members to be present at board meetings, but we know, because we work with these things on a daily basis, there are instances and times when not members are available, including the chairperson and or the deputy chairperson. And in order not to stifle then the continued operations of the entity, we generally allow that a situation happens that the members present, if they form the quorum, they nominate amongst themselves and the person to serve as the chairperson for the day, and that person then assumes all the responsibility of the chairperson for the meeting. The issue of CEO appointing employees of INESI as the board may determine. What is important here is that the determination by the board does not have to be an arbitrary, you know, day-to-day kind of determination. It gets encoded as part of the company policies, you know, so that it's not just an arbitrary decision that if there is this person A or B, that the board has a particular leaning towards that person, then that a new dispensation gets created, you know. So it's something that gets encoded in the policies of the entity, and then the CEO is generally entrusted with effecting those. But There are just cases where this function cannot be entirely left to the CEO. For instance, if you are appointing people that are reporting to the CEO, you know, you then only have the CEO as part of the employees to oversee the recruitment process. Then in those cases, then a board members through the HR committee will participate in the process, you know, so that there is enough of oversight. So what I'm trying to say is the determination by the board on remuneration is not a willy-nilly thing that they can change, chop and change as they wish, but it's something that is encoded in policy, and if they wish to amend that, that gets properly amended through the system. Honorable Sotetsi raised an issue that we need to perhaps be clear about the regular reporting to government and to all the structures and stakeholders. I thinking from the top of my head, I am unable to come up with perhaps a better elucidation of what regularly stands for here. Again, I will be hopefully assisted by the committee and my colleagues. We have spoken about the post-school higher education system. The qualification for being a member of the board, Honorable Sotetsi again, is proposing that we perhaps consider limiting the number of boards the member or the prospective member serves in. Again, this is a valid concern. We know of instances where board members are overstretched and are therefore not doing justice to their responsibility as board members to all institutions. But we have not quite been able to come up with a rule of thumb with the number of boards that should form the maximum that members must serve in. I think we will welcome the guidance of the committee here on what should be considered the number of boards that people may be limited to serve in. And of course the issue of inability to serve and attend meetings, as Honorable Sotetsi said, is indeed integrally linked to the number of boards that members serve. Honorable Mackenzie raises the issue of whether ICAMVA, you know, cannot be best served by just residing within the department. I think these were all the options which were considered in developing the business case, and the preferred option was to have an entity that will specialize in this kind of work, you know, noting capacity constraints within the department and so on. This in my view allows then for the employment of specialist people who will do the work. What we envisage the institute to do is mainly three things. One is to develop the strategic direction in terms of digital skills development that needs to happen in one house or one room where specialist people are gathered together to develop that. Indeed, that will be done in consultation with the department, but we felt an arm's length institution is better suited to do that. The second one, of course, is to steer the skills development agenda. And in other words, you assess the environment, what is happening, what are the gaps, and what is the speed and magnitude of these skills that we're developing, and then you try to direct the industry. Rather than replicating or perhaps duplicating what is happening there, we are proposing an organization that will harness, drive the current providers into developing the skills that would have been identified to be priority skills. So that steering mechanism is done because then the funding for the program goes through UNESCO, which then uses that to direct, in, and of course in a cooperative manner, the intermediaries, which are colleagues who are delivering this to developing new sets of curriculum, increasing on an ongoing basis the intake of people to be skilled, and so on and so on. The last function has to do with actually the research aspect of this. Indeed, there are many private institutions that are doing this work, but unfortunately, we don't know how many, how much work is being done on an ongoing basis, and we are looking, therefore, at this institute to collect all this work and start to give a picture of what is happening. That, again, research also informs then the other function of strategic direction of the sector. So the consolidation of what is happening, the understanding of what is happening, and what are the necessary interventions to further improve the program, all of that happens at INES. Then the partners or colleagues or other intermediaries will then do the actual skills training, you know, getting the curriculum accredited through the correct accrediting bodies and so on. So that is how we see it. So in finalizing the business case, that was the option taken, which we found best articulates the program. On the issue of no less than six, I think, and no more than 10 members, Those are members additional to the chairperson, deputy chairperson, and the executive members, who are essentially the CFO and the CEO. So we just allowed for that flexibility there, that at least those additional members not be less than six, but certainly not be more than 10, just to give us an effective and fully functional board. On the suggestion that perhaps we need to allow for the minister to re-advertise before he considers other avenues of getting board members, while this suggestion is generally accepted, but you know, knowing ourselves as South Africans, we do things on last minute, and if you know there's going to be a second advertisement, if you did not make yourself a nomination, then you will wait for the second advertisement. You know, so I think again here we will be guided. But my sense immediately is that it potentially creates that mischief. You know, which then people will just say, let the first advertisement go by. We will see it on the second advertisement. On disclosure of interest, yes, I think the interest that needs to be disclosed, yes, includes immediate family and other dependents, and I think there has been actually an evolution of governance documentation, which spells out who is related or an immediate family and who are the dependents, you know. So we can beef up this section here, which talks about disclosure, using that work that has already been developed in other areas. Areas of expertise, again, for CEO and other employees, if the committee feels that we need to list them here, flesh them out here, I think we can happily do that. Honorable Ndongeni raised the question of, therefore, if we say chairperson, deputy chair, no less than six, no more than 10, CEO, CFO, therefore, how many board members are we talking about? I guess at a minimum, we're talking 10, maximum, we're talking about 14. That's how it will be. So always the board would have a minimum of 10 board members, including two executives.
Maximum or minimum?
Minimum. So did I say that? No, maximum is 14.
Maximum is 14.
We'll. Mashangu, you then raised the issue of disqualifications and why do we disqualify only politicians. I understood you not to be making a case that politicians be included as board members, but you are saying why not think of officials as well, you know.
I don't know what I'm thinking, but proceed.
At least that's how I heard you.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Look, the disqualification of politicians is, it's obvious that we have made it a norm. But what was the reason that we excluded politicians? It's because we felt they exercise a certain power, and therefore it's almost a double dipping now, but there's an opening now there for very powerful people like you serving as a board member. How would we react to such? I mean, it doesn't, you are not disqualified from participating. Why do we have that kind of an opening?
You are not getting remunerated. You have public service on boards of government entities.
What is precluding them from participating?
Well, they're employed by the state. Why should they then serve on the board of the state entity? If they're employees of the state, they have full-time responsibility.
I'm saying. There is no provision that says they shall not. That's exactly what I'm saying. Papa Mackenzie?
Yes, thank you, Chair. As I read that clause, it says if, for example, you're appointed to the National Assembly or deployed by your party to the National Assembly and you happen to sit on the board, you must then step down from the board. I would see the practicalities of that. If I'm a Member of Parliament and I'm sitting on the board of ENESI, when you come and present your annual performance plan to me here, I'm going to be very favorably disposed towards you. I'm just going to take it off. So that immediate conflict of interest, I think that particular clause covers. Thank you, Chair.
Actually, I think this is the last question. So Chair, the issue of officials serving in other public entities, I think it's still a matter of a subject of debate. The DPSA has been mandated to come up with a framework for improving governance, you know, and including appointment of boards and so on. And at the moments where I've been able to sit in those discussions, the issue of officials, whether or not they should sit there, has been argued, you know, both ways. We have not seen the final determination in this respect, Chair. So I don't know if the Chair wishes that I articulate the points that have been made in these forums.
I would like to have the motivation why wouldn't have a problem if officials sit in that. Why? I mean, even the discussion that you are talking about, what are the discussions? Why is it not easy to conclude on the matter in the manner in which it has been dealt with by the politicians?
Chair.
Sorry?
Not really. The context in which this arises is not particularly where I would want or would be arguing to sit in the board of ENESI or any of the entities in our portfolio. But the question arises asking, should somebody who is an official in government who is sufficiently qualified be excluded then for serving in any of the public entities, you know.
Meaning politicians are not qualified.
meaning that person does not carry the kind of influence that we are talking about with respect to politicians, and is expected to just bring the technical expertise to that board, you know. So,
advocate like him, would you really qualify him for his expertise in law? Because he's a politician, so once you become a politician,
your qualification means nothing.
Mama Julie?
You see, Chairperson, it's obviously, the bill is in our hands now, so we can change it. The executive is out there, they sort of bite at it. They have told us what they want to create. We will now determine what makes good sense. Now, I think some of us have exactly the same feeling. It's not that we want to make out a case why members of parliament should serve or not serve. It's just that we also know that there has been the argument many, many moons ago that public officials usually have the expertise to be utilized in these boards. Now, it's a problem, Chairperson, because some of the public servants serving more than one board, and you can argue that whatever the salary package is that they are receiving, quite a portion of the time that they're supposed to be serving in their portfolio, they're not there. They're in fact participating in boards. Second point is, if the minister is to delegate a specific public official, it is a sort of ministerial delegation to serve in a board, and then with a clear understanding that that person is not deriving any financial benefits from it, because you cannot have double dipping. But I think it's something that we should argue about, and I understand your concern that one sector is excluded but not the other sector. And this debate, with great respect to the DDG, has been going on for years, and it will not be concluded soon because there is an interest in it, and we must make sure that we actually create the environment in which you cannot have these sort of double servicing. It this one serves in that entity and that one serves in this entity. I think it's time for us to really consider very clearly what we want to establish. If we say that the board is to be established with people with the necessary knowledge, then let's look for the persons with the skills. But you don't need to go to departments to find those skills. Thank you, Chair.
There are still those that like to talk?
No. Not specifically on this matter, thank you.
No. On the matter that has been raised.
Yes, Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Deputy Minister, Board Members, the issue of terminology has come into play. Perhaps one should discuss some of that. Could I just indicate the bigger definition is digital skills. Part of that in the taxonomy with which we work is digital literacy. And I just want to read quickly the definition we've got there because it addresses one point that came into play. Digital literacy, in other words, that sub-component, that literally that basic component within the digital skills space, is the ability of individuals to use digital skills and facilities to perform tasks, to solve problems, to communicate, to manage information, to collaborate, to create and share content. To create and share content. That is an important part of that. And then to build knowledge in all areas of everyday life and for work. So the concept of also generating knowledge, not only consuming knowledge, is included in that. But how it is eventually formulated is a matter for this committee to decide in the end.
You want the lawyers to speak to the matter?
Thank you, Chair, but in a, if I may, a different order, just add to some of the other questions just from a more legal angle. I think the one question was about 11.6 and how many board members are then part of the quorum because of this variance in board numbers. And the DDG answered that it's between 10 and 14, so it then just follows that it's two-thirds of the 10, 11, 12, 13, or 14, depending on firstly eligibility, then you determine your board, your number that are eligible, which can be 10 to 14, and then from there you count backwards to figure out what two-thirds of that number would be. In the case of 14, then it becomes more difficult to calculate, but it's likely to be to be 10. The question of regularly is one that, if read in that section, it's really about the functions of ANESI, which is broadly representing the powers and functions of ANESI as opposed to specific, for example, reporting requirements. If it was about specific reporting requirements, you would say who you report to, how regularly, whether it's annually, for example, after financial statements were audited, etc. But in this context, it would talk about the functions and say regularly monitor and advise government, business, and relevant bodies on digital and multimedia literacy levels. So you'll see it's one of those things you can't even directly measure it because who's government and who's business and who's education and training, and similarly, what exactly is that advice? So one could possibly drop the word regularly by simply say the function is to monitor and advise. But here it makes it slightly stronger by saying regularly monitor and advise. At least it says it's not about doing it once in a lifetime. It must be done on a constant basis. But then the matter in 16.1, the DDG already answered. But one must also read it with 16.2. So though the board has a say in determining such terms and conditions, 16.2 applies in parallel, which says that it must be consistent with that paid in the public sector. So yes, it's specific categories like remuneration and allowances and subsidies and other benefits, but you have to read that qualification with 16.1, and therefore, even though it ends up in policies and so on of the organization as explained, the board is also limited and must be guided then by what is paid in the public sector, for example. Then the difficult question that we have also undertaken to go back and just confirm, however, is the matter of the Companies Act. So we see it as follows at this point in time. So if you take the post office or the post bank, for example, when MPs were here writing the post bank legislation, there's a process built in there that makes provision for the establishment of a company, and therefore the post bank, as an example, ending up as a company at the end of the day. And the legislation specifically dealt with the extent to which the Companies Act would apply and so on. But in this case, in other legislation, what you do is you simply establish a juristic person. That's the route taken in this particular legislation. So if you read it with the definition in the Companies Act of public entity, or rather of state-owned company, it says it includes public entity. So if you stop reading there,
you would say, okay, that means INESI is in fact a state-owned company under the Companies Act. But if you read further, it says, but if registered under the Companies Act. So from our reading, it doesn't automatically become some form of an SOC under the Companies Act. And the fact is, it's not established as a company. There's no provision in this law wherever the current NAMISA and ISA and so on are a form of a legal entity or a company that's just automatically converted. There's no provision anywhere for that, so which means it becomes a juristic person. Then the question would remain open if the question is, if the Companies Act does not apply, which other provisions must be included in the bill? And that I guess anyone can answer. If anyone notices something that's glaringly missing in this bill that is in fact required to ensure a proper governance law, then that must be pointed out so that we see how to formulate that. I think which takes us right to the next issue that was raised, I think, from the beginning with from the chair's side, which was a valid one, the matter of fiduciary duties. From a first glance of things, it looks like there are no fiduciary duties. And in our first response, we tried to at least point out a few fiduciary duties that are sort of hidden or scattered around. But then the DG already responded, I think, that Section 50 of the PFMA, which then applies to INESI as a Schedule 3 national public entity, it's captured there, the fiduciary duties of the board in Section 50. So if we're happy with that, if we read Section 50 of the PFMA and we say, well, these are proper and they're sufficient and good enough, then it means we've covered fiduciary duties. If there's something wrong with that, then we have to add more fiduciary duties. So that's the way we need to approach that. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, Chair, I don't want to rehash issues, but I just wanted to add some of what I've got in my notes. The first issue that I have, and it goes back to definitions, is the very title of the bill. We use the term e-skills instead of the digital skills, and nowhere in the bill do we refer to e-skills. So that's just something that we must think about, because there's no congruency there. So either we change it to digital skills, or alternatively we change digital skills to e-skills. I do think that we're making the bill unnecessarily long by defining multimedia and then using multimedia every single time we use the term digital skills, because then it also creates interpretation issues later on. Because if this is an evolving sphere, and there are going to be new things that are added in 50 years' time that we don't know about now, then the argument would be, well, if it's not included, then it's definitely excluded, because why did we include multimedia as a separate facet? So we must just be very careful from an interpretation point of view. Then in terms of the collabs, collabs are defined as being located within post-school education and training institutions. And there's a definition of those institutions later on. I think it's the fifth last definition. And in that definition, you'll see at the end that it includes skills providers. Now, that's a very broad term, because every Tom, Dick, and Harry these days are providing skills and some sort of certificates of some type or the other. Now, I cannot understand rationally how you would have a collab that could be situated within a private company, for example, that's a skills provider. I would think that this could only be in terms of registered institutions, and the department can perhaps just think about that and then respond to us in due course. Then on the functions of INESI, I think that the role of the minister is conspicuously absent here. There doesn't seem, to me it seems that this entity is going to stand very much independent and do whatever it wishes to fulfill these functions. There's one report that goes to the minister, which is the annual report, but there's nothing in here that says that the minister may utilize INESI to do research or utilize INESI to do any of these things. It's saying you can do it, but there's nothing in here that links the department to the entity, because you don't want a situation where the minister decides that there is a need for research or some other sort of work to be done, and INESI simply says, well, we don't want to use our resources there. It's not part of our annual plan or whatever the case. I think there's a bit of a missing link there. Then in subsection 2, this is, I'm still on 4 now, subsection 2A, there's reference there to the digital skills framework and the training and development model. We use capital letters there. I assume that it is an actual framework that perhaps exists. I couldn't find any reference to it, so we can't just be referring to something unless we all fully aware of what is being referred to. I'm not sure if this is something that must still be developed, so we definitely need some more information there. And then for me, Chair, the biggest thing, and perhaps, you know, I haven't been part of this process from the beginning, so perhaps I don't have an understanding, but I think it's important when we draft that we draft for third parties, that anybody looking at the Act from the outside must be able to understand how things are going to operate. So I'll forgive myself for not understanding. But in terms of Section 5, the establishment of these collabs, for me, a fundamental issue here that I think is very unclear is what the financial model for these collabs are. Because we use the term collaboration, and collaboration is a very loose term. Collaboration doesn't necessarily mean that I need to give you any financial assistance. We could collaborate by me giving my resources, whatever I have available, and you giving your resources. Now, it's unclear to me whether these collabs actually exist or able to exist from a financial point of view, purely because of money that is coming from the department, and that money is now going to be funded via INESI. If that is the case, I assume that funding will be done via transfer agreements in terms of the PFMA. I think we need to be clear about that, because you're going to land up with a strange auditing issue here. The Auditor General will audit INESI, but they won't be auditing of the collabs. So there's a huge risk if that's actually where money is going to end up eventually, and INESI, as I understand, is more conduit here, that money then gets mismanaged. So I think that there's a bit of a gap for me in Section 5, and that we need to beef that up. Then also Section 5 refers to things like the Quality Council, or an appropriate Quality Council. I'm not sure what that means. And again, we use capital letters there, so I think we just need more information on that. In terms of the establishment and appointment of the board, in terms of the King Code, the latest King Code 4, which is now drafted in such a manner as to be applicable to even an entity like INESI, the board certainly will not be responsible for day-to-day affairs. I think we can clean that drafting up. The day-to-day is a management function. I think the way the board is constituted, we'd also need to clean that up to distinguish properly between the executive members and the non-executive members, because for now it's all pooled together, and it's important when you figure out the voting rights. And again, in terms of the King Code, you want to think about whether you want executive members to have voting rights or you want the board to be completely independent. But those are things that the department must come back to us and show us that they've looked at the code and the appropriate governance issues, because you don't want too much of intermingling. I mean, the King Code is quite clear about that, because that's when all of the issues start creeping in, because the hand that feeds you is the one that's making the decisions, really. So we need to be careful about that. Then on the same section, on 6.8, we talk about where the minister haven't found people that have the required expertise and socioeconomic profiles. That idea of a socioeconomic profile is completely new. Nowhere in the preceding sections do we talk about these members having a particular socioeconomic profile. So it's not clear whether the intention there was to say that board members should perhaps be broadly representative of race, gender, and language representation in terms of what the Republic looks at, or whether it should be geographical, or whatever the issue is. But I think we need more information on that, and we need to build that into the appointment of board members to say that they should reflect these characteristics, so that you have a diverse board, if that is the intention. Otherwise, we must take out this reference to socioeconomic profile, because I'm not sure what that means. Six, four, let me just see. It says demographics. The problem with the term demographics is it's been interpreted differently. So I've been in committees where Parliament's actually part of the body that appoints. So if I think off the cuff, the National Youth Development Agency. So an interesting thing that happened in that committee is that it was interpreted to mean geographic location. So we just made sure that there was a board member from each province. And that could result in you not getting the best composition, because you now deciding you want board members from a particular place rather than the best board member. So it's an important thing to think about. But the department can come back to us on that. Then in terms of Section 7, the term of office of members of the board, if you look at subsection 3, it allows the minister to extend the term of office for a period of not more than 6 months or until a new board has been appointed. I just thought that we might want to look at that drafting. It could look as if it's open-ended. I know the intention there is that within 6 months the minister must appoint a new board, but we might want to just clean up the drafting there a little bit. Then in 7.1, we talk about a person who's been convicted of an offence and sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine, not being eligible any longer. But then particularly for fraud, we talk about a fine or imprisonment. And my question to the department is, why only that offence and not other offences where there might also be a fine, other serious offences like corruption? Fraud is one particular offence with a particular definition. And in terms of combating corrupt activities, there are many specific acts that may look like fraud but that are not fraud, other sorts of corrupt activities. And do we then want to list those, or what the intention there is as to why they chose fraud specifically. Then at the end of that section, in subsection 4, we talk about board members tendering their resignation and the minister accepting it. My legal understanding is that a resignation is a unilateral act. We don't need the minister to accept the resignation, because what would you do legally if the minister refuses to accept the resignation? The mischief you're actually trying to prevent there is you don't want somebody resigning all of a sudden and then not giving the minister adequate notice in order to fill that position, because it could affect your quorum or whatever the case may be. So perhaps what you want to do there is rather build in a notice period, because I don't believe legally that the minister can choose not to accept a resignation. Disclosure of interest, I've also got it on my notes that this is very thin. I think it definitely needs to be beefed up. The other thing that it doesn't include in that disclosure of interest is that it only talks about appointment, whereas this should be upon appointment and then annually, or even biannually, whatever the case is. But it certainly can't be upon appointment only, because you're going to find that in year two, board members will simply refuse because they'll say that isn't a legal requirement to declare the conflict of interest. So that definitely needs to be beefed up. Then in terms of the appointment of staff, the chief executive officer and the CFO, I think we need to be clear whether these appointments are going to be subject to the Public Service Act, because that, again, is missing. I know there's reference to other labour legislation, but I think we need to be clear, especially because we do have this issue about salary levels that have come up. So I think we have given too much power to the board to simply determine what those salary levels should be, and perhaps we can tie it up with some reference to the Act and appropriate levels in terms of the Act. And then, Chair, yeah, that's about it from my side. Chair, my general view is that there's still considerable work to be done. We've seen in terms of these entities that when legislation is quiet on how governance should happen, that those board members will be very quick to say that something like the King Code, whilst it can be applied to us, is not legally applicable. It's not binding. So I think it's important that we look at those codes and look at the specific provisions that we want to incorporate and make it law here, because it is quite thin. It isn't subject to the Companies Act. I'm in agreement that it's just a juristic entity that can sue and be sued. The PFMA, while it does deal with financial issues, it also gives quite a bit of leeway to the board to determine how to run and how to manage issues. So for me, one of the missing things here, which I'm not getting to grip with, is what the role of the department is vis-a-vis this entity. Whether you want the entity to run completely independently and for it not to be tied into what the department's strategic objectives are. Are they deciding for themselves? Because at the end of the day, this is government money, so it should form part of the greater plans that government has in this sphere and in other sectors. And for me, that link is missing, and perhaps it is just a drafting issue and the department understands it. And I know that they've referred several times to the fact that there are policies in place and there are these secondary documents, but those documents remain just that. If it's not in the Act, it remains just that, and those things are open to interpretation. So for me, if we could draw all of these things together and just beef up the drafting, it will save us some trouble in the long run, because then everybody's on the same page and understands exactly what must be done. But those are just my broad comments for now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I think very, very valuable comments and very important issues have been flagged. How soon can we come with some reworked document taking all these concerns into account and closing the gaps? Before you come in, Madam Killian and Madam Sotete.
I think what we actually need at this stage is our parliamentary legal advisor to just give us a synopsis. I mean, she's gone through everything very nicely and she touched on issues that we've also raised. And I was just wondering, because in the end, we want to see the provisions in the Act, because we are on the same page, I think, members of this committee, that policies are there, hanging in the air, very nice, but they do not have the legal binding nature. And what we want to create here is not another state entity that, once it's launched, it runs on its own course. So if we could perhaps, what we have done in the past is we've asked a parliamentary legal advisor to work with the department legal advisor to see where they can find each other, but we must make it abundantly clear, Chair, that this is now the responsibility of Parliament. So we're not going to negotiate with the department. We're going to say to the department, this is what we need to make sure that we have the King Code provisions encapsulated in the Act, etc. So I would suggest that we either get the document from our legal advisor or that we wait then for deliberations between the legal advisor and the department, and that they then present a document to us so that we can work on that, because we will have to go through the detail to say what, where is it going to go to. Chair, I know that we want to conclude it, but let's agree that we want to pass a good piece of legislation and rather go through it with a fine comb and make sure that we are all on the same page. Our definitions are, in fact, forward-looking and not restricting us. So that would be my plea. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. On 9-1, page 6, I think it comes back to the statement that should be explicit so that we have the same understanding. And also, you know, legal terminology is different from simple English. On 9-1 here, where it says a member of the board must, upon appointment, disclose any interest annually. What happens in a situation whereby by the time when you were appointed, you didn't have a certain, you know, amount of money in your bank, but somewhere along the way, do we have to wait for that annual reporting, or maybe there must be something specific to say a certain amount of money you should be, you know, reporting to the minister within 7 or 14 days or whatever time, because you might be overtaken by the media. By the time you are waiting to disclose that annual something, because it's open, say, annual, I'll wait for whatever time. It's not just, I've just started a lack of 10 million, I get a lotto or tender or something. Do I have to wait to you know, report that annual something, or immediately when it's a certain amount of money, like in tenders, they say someone will sign if it's more than 500, someone won't sign if it's more than whatever. Like when you advertise, there's a certain amount of money you have to advertise. For me, I find it being very open to say you have to report annual. If something happens, something positive happens to you, how long should you wait before you report? And 9-2, I think, is just neither here nor there on 9-2. And on regularly, you say you can do away with it and be left with monitoring and advice. I'll feel that we better leave it as it is regularly, because when you say just monitoring and advice, it's also open. It's difficult for you to hold the person to account because there's no specific time, you know, that is specified, but regularly would be better than just leave it as monitoring and advice. And on re-advertising of, you know, the vacant space or not getting someone who's relevant to the advertisement, we hope it doesn't open up to a situation whereby a person whose qualifications are not relevant to the functions of the board is being appointed in the name of not getting someone who's relevant. Just to make sure that whoever is being appointed has the relevant qualification that matches the functions of the board. Thank you, Chair.
Good. Yeah. But my question is then, how long will it take for us to incorporate these issues that have been raised, close the gaps that have been identified, and present to the committee something to work on? I prefer that the lawyers speak. Our lawyer and the department lawyer, because we are limping in a way from our side, you know, because we don't have a content advisor and the researcher. You see, that's our weakest problem. And that's why I depend entirely on you, madam. Yes.
Chair, I don't want to commit my colleague, Ms. Ngema, in her absence. The bill is allocated to her, and I was told yesterday to stand in for her, but I'll assist her in continuing with the bill nonetheless. But that being said, Chair, I think a lot of the issues are in fact still policy issues that we need to sit with the department and decide. I don't think we're ready to move to an A-list G just yet, because we'll need to come back with new proposals of how to craft certain things and then get the permission of the committee to proceed with the A-list. The A-list is the document that is going to capture exactly the wording changes, and we wouldn't want to waste time and effort doing that only to come back to the committee and for members to feel that in actual fact they're in disagreement with what the proposal, the joint proposal is. Because what we do try to do is to find each other. It's unfortunate that we don't have a content advisor or researcher to assist us, because we're obviously not experts in terms of policy and this field, so it will be difficult when it comes to definitions and so on. But we certainly will make efforts to sit with the department, and I can go back to the office and speak to the colleagues. There's currently quite a few bills before Parliament, and we've been pushed significantly to get those done. So I don't want to commit to a date in the absence of that office discussion. But we can certainly liaise with the committee secretary either in the course of today or by tomorrow morning. But we'll try our utmost to do it. But if the department can start at least looking at some of the issues that we've raised, they are the content subject matter experts, that will assist you.
Actually, we're waiting for the department to, the silence means consent. But what I'm just saying is I also wanted to ask in terms of the consultation, financial implications for the state. I have not seen the regulatory impact analysis. Is that what you referred to earlier? Because what we need to see is the implementation plan. We also need to know as Parliament if we're creating an entity that's going to gobble up a lot of funds. Issues were raised as far as how do we keep CoLabs accountable? How will this dual sort of operation operate? And how will we ensure accountability? That's our critical role, Chair. So if they could please tell us when can we receive that as well?
Yeah, as you respond to the question, I would also want to listen to the lawyer. On the matter that we're raised, I think all right here has spoken, but I want to hear from this topic. Anyway, we are the interface, we need to collaboration in this regard. I think ours will be more of a quality check, the aspect is something that the department should be in position to do with Parliament specifically this work. Yeah, and then I have to respond to the question. Just before you respond, something very interesting in this bill, in comparison with other bills. For instance, you say, if you are a member of Parliament, just an example, you say you get disqualified if you are guilty, for instance, just on that aspect, and you are sentenced to a period no less than 12 months. No, not this one. But here, that's how you disqualify a member of the member of Parliament. You've got to be sentenced for no less than 12 months without an option of a fine.
This one, you get, once you have no option of a fine, you are gone. I mean, you can't be appointed. Why do we have different rules that are applying? Why do we have rules that apply differently? That one is the constitutional provision. Well, why is it so relaxed? And this one so strict? Why are members of Parliament given so much leeway to get away with murder of 11 months and 15 days? You are free to continue to be a member, but in this regard, one day without a fine, you are gone. But yeah, respond to the other questions. So the important one is indeed the aspect that was raised earlier on as to how long it can take us, what will it take, because we need to plan our program going forward. And I think the dedication by the department to increase the capacity to deal with all these issues that we have raised, DM, becomes very, very crucial. But TDG, I know you lead the delegation at the administrative level, but I would like to hear a lawyer speaking before you wena ukhulume muva wena ke bakhulume laba abafanele bawenze lo msebenzi kodwa ke nangabe ubambele eduze ngizwile nayo cha uyayisondela le ndaba ungaqhubeka mfethu.
I wanted to comment on this one. I don't only lead the team at this meeting today, but I lead the team even at the department in as so far as this bill is concerned. So it becomes my ultimate responsibility with the support of the team. Chair, the point I was going to raise, I think the parliamentary legal advisor has also raised it. We do need to have guidance at a principal level on some of these things. Then we go away, we do the technical drafting and coming up with the proposals. You know, there was an issue. If I were to make an example, the bill currently says minimum 6 and maximum 10 other board members. There was a view that perhaps the maximum of all board members must be 10. Those kind of things. Then we are able to do most of the cleanup as long as we get a principal and at times specific decision on some of these things. Some of these things we can explain as is expected of us to explain where we were coming from, and then we craft the best possible provision, you know.
He chose the easy one. Well, I guess that those ones are not very complicated. It's easy to deal with that matter because it's a question of a number. But the other aspects, I don't think that there were views that were different. We were actually identifying gaps, and therefore once the gaps that have been identified gets dealt with and they are put on paper in some draft form, with alternatives, for instance, then it makes it easy for us to debate the aspect and agree. If there are members who are saying 10 and others are saying max 8, you can put both ideas and then we can then take a decision on a particular matter. But there are these things where gaps have been identified, where you need to explain certain things, fill certain things, clarify certain things, bring certain things that may necessarily not be properly clarified. You find it in the PFMA, or you find, not PFMA, but the Companies Act, you know, all those things that have been flagged as matters that require clarity, that may create confusion, are for me very crucial. The other matters of what 10 or 15 or 8, those things are very easy to deal with. In the manner in which is crafted, also it's just a question that it creates some confusion, the voting, the threshold, the participation of the executive, da, 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 da. All those things have got certain implications, and I know me and Julie hold a view, for instance, that executives should not vote. They shouldn't vote, because that's double dipping. They are the creators of all the things that get presented to the board, and therefore come and vote again. It can't be correct. But that's what they do sometimes. They participate and vote, and they can actually even outvote members. So they should present their issues. Should they form a quorum? No. They sit there by virtue of being holding certain positions. If tomorrow they get suspended, they get suspended for accountability purposes. If they get suspended tomorrow, Shelebe gets suspended as a CEO, and then comes Mr. Marais representing Shelebe. He sits there. So Shelebe is not a board member. His position is actually a board member. The board member is a position, not the person. because you can only participate by virtue of either CEO, COO, I mean CEO and CFO. So those are executive members. It's our view is that the independent members should be the people that are responsible for the quorum, for the decision, for the voting, and so on and so on. As to the number, I guess those things we can always decide. I didn't hear people, well, the race issue of 8 and why 8, does 8 include the 2? Does it include the other 2? So if we talk of a quorum, the quorum should not include the executive members. And Julie's view is that quorum, when a decision is taken, either the chair or the deputy should be present. In other words, you can't take a decision in the absence of the two because those people have got a direct appointment by the minister. And there's a reason for it, but indeed, as to how that can get crafted, something else. But it's a very strong, I support that view. Because what happens in certain instances, people would invite people into a meeting or call for a meeting. The chair is not there, the deputy is not there. It's beautiful timing. And then things got pushed through. And by the time the other guys who are directly responsible and accountable to the minister by virtue of the appointment, decisions have been taken. So her motivation makes sense. But for some people, they may say, no, but these guys are absent for whatever reasons. They carry too much power. Why should it be dependent upon them? What if they don't want a meeting? You know, but you need to have those kind of things. But yeah, I guess that's it. Shalem.
If I may, before my legal person comes in, I see you are holding me to the example I used, you know, to demonstrate the point I was trying to make. It's just an example I used, but there's a whole host of other ones which are really matters of principle, and if properly guided, then it's a matter of just going to do the drafting. Chair, I am happy to end on a note which says we are going to engage with the legal people of Parliament. Some of these things I believe we can still explain at least where we're coming from. We are not particularly married on how the provision is phrased, just the capturing of the principle where we come from. Then we can find one another on how we deal with those. Just perhaps on the role of government departments, you know, or minister in this thing, the PFMA, which we say is the law that also governs this entity, is very clear on how these entities account to the minister through the department for strategic planning, for budgeting, and quarterly reporting on those things. You know, so we have already a framework now. The question is, to what extent do you go and try and export those things into this bill, Chair? But I will ask my legal person to also make a comment before we end.
I'm sorry, Chairperson, but yeah. But what I just wanted to say was I think the Parliamentary Legal Advisor made a very good point, and that is it relates to creating an entity, and off it goes. There it is. It's being funded, public funds, but the line of roping in to see if the entity is performing its mandate. And there is no clear indication of how to hold the entity to its mandate for which it and its purpose that it was created. And I think that's where the problem lies. PFMA is something else. It's accounting for financial matters, etc. But making sure that there's a very short leash between the department and this entity. That's where we need to write in additional provisions for governance sake, because we have seen what could go wrong with governance of public entities. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess what we should do, Bab Shalem, working with the Parliamentary Legal services is to, for a lack of appropriate thoughts, you know, we could have something within the crafted document that looks at options or different things. What are you saying? Something that would almost look like your minority report and majority report in courts, but not in different sections. For instance, in the same line where there are different thoughts. Say, for instance, our parliamentary advisor, legal advisor, has already spoken and said several things that the department feels differently. You have the department's view and crafted in purple and the green in what parliamentary advisor says. And then we will discuss those things, and we can then move forward. It will actually help us. Because we will not be in a position, seated here, to rehash the things that we have raised earlier and assist you to move forward. But I think the thoughts that have been spoken, even some of the things that you may pick up that we may not have raised, to make sure that we have a very solid, clean bill that will result in a better act. Closing the gaps that we experience, what Julia just said, you have entities that litigate against their own ministers very easily. Yeah. At the slightest provocation, they take you to task and tell you you've got no authority. And then they go and use the PFMA, the Companies Act to litigate against the minister when it suits them, and they change to another. So those clarities are very crucial as we go forward so that our bills are cleaner, tighter, and much more solid, and avoid all the things that, USASA is an example now. On some of the decisions they are taking, even against your advices, and they are pushing on. When you touch them, they go to court. So let's close all those gaps. Let's not legislate to deal with problems, but let's make sure that we are much more on a solid foundation in whatever we are crafting. And we are free to listen to you, especially your legal people, even if you differ with the parliamentary, but let's put those facts together, like we say, go through it in a truth comp and make sure that even things that we have not raised that you believe are a problem, highlight them and present them and say, well, you never raised this thing, but as we're engaging as a team, we pick up this thing and we felt. And some of the things that we have raised, we believe that the things you have raised, yeah, but these are the gaps in what you have raised, and we believe that the best way is this thing. So let's work on it in such a way that we can present something that will help us move forward. If that does make any sense. Fine, madam.
Member?
Prof?
I'm happy with the path that has now been identified here.
Good. State law? You are not allowed to speak in a meeting.
No, we have no issues. No. Should the department request any assistance from us, and we're happy to do that, and to work with the parliamentary advisor as well.
DM, are we fine? Any parting words? Or are you fine?
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Just to say we appreciate all the comments, inputs, and advices that have been given. I will make sure that before we come back to the Portfolio Committee, at least we've tried to attend to all of those that have been specifically raised and to look at other issues as we have proposed. We are hoping that the two teams from our side and your side, Parliament, in terms of the legal side, will be able to find each other in terms of clarifying and unpacking all those matters that don't seem to be clear. Thank you so much.
Colleagues, we will push you harder. I will do it out of this meeting, but I don't think that you'll have more than 14 days to come back. I don't think you will get any grace beyond that. So, yeah. Good. I think on that aspect we are fine. Colleagues, the other day Ajira, where are we with our request for the thing that's happening 2 weeks from now? But what are the indications?
It's going to the house chair.
It's going to the house chair. Okay. Okay. Ngingakhululeka nangabe nina singangihlaliseli nje nangabe akuna anything. It's almost in the housekeeping method. Colleagues, we are just looking at our program. So it means they'll be back here. Unless if they could be done. Yeshalem. Nasithe 2 weeks of it, asisho ukuthi in 2 weeks. Kungenzeka ukuthi umvelase akutshele ukuthi endoda ingathi sesiphele inhliziyo. Because as our parliamentary advisor was saying, we got in at the last. We actually were given grace as telecoms to come in. We were outside the deadline. So we're given grace. So we aren't going to push you. And if we can honor and not disappoint Parliament, they will listen to us in future. But if we fail, we are going to deny other people an opportunity. People who are committing to work tirelessly and make sure they finish on time, you will actually fail it, and you would be failing yourself in future. Because I know you've got another bill that you want dealt with. If you're not moving with speed, if you're not burning the midnight candle, you may not get grace from us as well as power. So if you could push harder. Don't look at the 2 weeks. If you could actually work overnight and push for the next week, it would be very helpful.
We are already talking about choking them.
Okay, it's fine.
Maybe it's tomorrow.
Okay, perfect. Okay, I did say last week that we received an invitation to the International Telecoms Conference, which is taking place in Durban. We had sent an application. We have not received a feedback from the House Chair. I will follow up on the matter because I felt very strong that hosting an international conference on telecom, it will be very beneficial for members of this committee, all of them, to attend. It's in Durban. Taking place, I think, from the 10th to the 14th of next month. Yes. So you want us to deal with them now? Okay, perfect. Okay. Yeah, you have to. So next week, we were supposed to continue with the bill. What we will do, though, is to get some briefing or get a briefing as to how far we are, and then also deal with the outstanding matters of which is the minutes. Baba Mackenzie?
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure it's the right time, but there's never a right time. The South African Post Office, it's critical that we engage with them at this time. the communication that's come from, you know, if we have a gap in our calendar, maybe we can just get two people from the SAPA, the CEO would be useful, just to explain what is happening with that entity. I mean, the communication we received was originally the backlog would be cleared by end of August. I now get my information from the media, and I have to read there that the backlog will be cleared by the end of September. And, you know, what is happening with that organization? Thank you, Chair.
Consider it done, Mr. McKenzie, sir. I was going to discuss it in my management, but you see, I could not have announced it here, because we normally have a management and we look at, especially if we find a gap like next week. But thank you for that. It's something we had actually considered already. Ngiyabonga kakhulu mnumzane.